Eat and you feel full.
Don, you just ate. Your brain should have plenty of leptin.
But scientists at Cambridge University discovered that leptin also influences the so-called reward centers of the brain, which control food cravings and the pleasure we feel from eating. Their study looked at brain activity and cravings in two rare patients who can't produce leptin. Researchers scanned the brains of these volunteers in their leptin-deficient condition. The subjects were shown photos of both food and non-food items after they had been fasting and again after eating. In the absence of leptin, the brain regions responsible for cravings were activated by food images, and volunteers described the food images as highly desirable, whether or not they were full. The subjects were then treated with leptin for 7 days, and the experiment was repeated. This time, the reward centers were most active, and food images were reported as more desirable when the subjects had been fasting. So not only does leptin signal when we've had enough to eat, but may also regulate the desire and craving for food, regardless of our actual needs.
Well, unfortunately for you and your cravings, I ate all the pie.
This moment of science comes from Indiana University.
Today's program was prepared by Sue Ann Zollinger, with help from Gregory Demas in biology. I'm Yael Cassander.
And I'm Don Glass.
Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences of all ages to experience the lively fiddling and entertaining step dancing of Natalie McMaster on January 26th. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Let's take a look at what's happening today in the world of sports. John Ferguson has been fired from his job as general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs. Former GM Cliff Fletcher takes over on an interim basis. The Leafs are 14th in the NHL 16-team Eastern Conference and appear headed toward a third straight season without a playoff berth. Tampa Bay coach John Gruden and Buccaneers general manager Bruce Allen have new 3-year contract extensions, taking them through the 2011 campaign. A season after a 4-12 finish, the Bucs rebounded to post a 9-8 mark and capture the NFC South crown. In an attempt to shore up a leaky bullpen, the Chicago White Sox have agreed to a 2-year deal with Octavio Dotel. The 34-year-old right-hander went 2-1 with a 4.11 ERA last season with Kansas City and Atlanta, while being limited to only 33 appearances by an injury to his pitching shoulder. And defending champion Serena Williams and top-seeded Justine Henin were bounced from the Australian Open today. Williams dropped a 6-3 to 6-4 decision to third seed Yelena Yankovic, while Henin lost 6-4, 6-love to Maria Sharapova, ending a 32-match winning streak. That's sports. Soon, all seniors in Illinois will be able to ride public transportation for free. Governor Rod Blagojevich was in Peoria yesterday to promote the program. Jonathan Ahl reports.
Norma Jean Young lives at the Heartland Apartments in Peoria. She usually takes the bus to get where she wants to go. But when money's tight, she walks or asks a family member or friend to drive her. Young says it's easier to take the bus.
You know, and then the weather beats so bad at times, you don't want to go out there. You know, and that bus is here. It's convenient for, you know, it helps. You know, let you know you're here.
Young says she and her friends will feel more independent because of the free rides from the state.
They have the, you know, they feel more independent. And maybe someday people come say, well, we did our shopping already, you know. Especially in the kind of weather. Snow and rain.
The program is part of an amendatory veto from Governor Rod Blagojevich on a bailout plan for the public transit systems in Chicago and the suburbs. The deal will increase sales taxes only in Cook and the Collar counties. But Blagojevich used the opportunity to mandate free rides for seniors statewide. The governor says it will make a difference.
Now, I know it's 50 cents here in Peoria. It's higher in other places. But if you're taking the bus here in Peoria, let's say four days a week, and you're taking it one way and then you take it back, that's $1 a day, $4 a week. You're talking about $200 a year, and I think $200 in savings for seniors is better than having $200 less in their pockets.
The state is also helping downstate transit systems pay for the free rides with extra grants. For CityLink, serving the Peoria area, that means an extra $2 million this year. Tom Lusek is the interim general manager at CityLink. He says the program may actually be a major windfall to the region.
Well, because we've had senior citizens at a discount already, they only pay 50 cents. So we only had $20,000 in revenue last year from senior citizens. So if we gain $2 million and lose $20,000, that's a pretty good trade-off. And with the additional money that we get, we'll be providing better service for all the fare-paying passengers.
While the program has widespread support in the Peoria area, some are left out. Disabled seniors that use the CityLift paratransit system will not be included in the program. That concerns Elizabeth Bowles. She uses CityLift and says her transportation costs add up quickly.
For instance, the other day I went to the store, stopped and got my medicine. It cost me $6 in transportation. You know, that's not cheap, you know. So it'd be nice to get a little off on that if I could. You know, I'm not proud.
Adding the disabled to the free rides program is the next step, according to the governor. That bill is currently stuck in the state Senate, where lawmakers may try to use it as a bargaining chip in their ongoing political battle with the governor. I'm Jonathan Aul.
It's 2:46. Natural disasters are one thing, but when it is a disaster that takes a century to unfold, it's harder to get those most affected to think about it. That's a problem many low-lying countries are encountering in the face of rising sea levels. As part of the Climate Connection series with National Geographic, NPR's Joe Palca went to Holland, a country that is actually rethinking its thousand-year-old strategy of fighting back against the water in the face of this enormous but slow-moving threat.
To understand the history of the Dutch battle against water, a great person to track down is Geert Mak. He's a writer by trade, but he's one of these guys who think deeply about topics, and he's thought a lot about the Dutch relationship with water.
You see everywhere here ditches and small old canals.
Mak is every bit the urban intellectual, but he also maintains a rural hideaway in Friesland in the north of Holland. That's where I caught up with him. The ditches and canals are not just scenery. They're a critical part of the man-made drainage system that keeps this soggy country from filling up like a bathtub. Mak points out the window of his modern farmhouse at the flat field stretching off to the horizon.
This is the pancake country. But when you look well, you see a very small, hills. They call it terpen.
When the Romans were here 2,000 years ago, they figured out that making a bit of high ground to build your house on would keep you dry when the floodwaters came in. Beating back the ocean, draining lakes and turning them into farmland, Mak says the Dutch have always worked aggressively to protect themselves from high water. And yet now, Mak says something puzzling is happening in the Netherlands. People seem to believe that only poor low-lying countries like Bangladesh are going to be affected by the sea level rise that will come with global warming.
I'm amazed all the time because we are a very rich Bangladesh, we are a very modern Bangladesh, but we are a kind of Bangladesh. And we are one of the first victims of the climate changes.
It's as if the Dutch have tuned out the threat of climate change.
This whole problem with water, with weather, with storms, with climate change, they have the idea it is far away, while it is really, it is at their door. They're sleeping.
There was a time some 50 years ago when the Dutch were equally oblivious to their peril. Leave Friesland and head south to a town like Willemstad, not far from the North Sea, and people will tell you about the night of January 31st, 1953. A night when a horrific storm awoke people to the danger at their door.
It was a weekend evening, and full moon, very strong winds from the northwest, high tides.
That's Jerry Meyerman. He was 9 years old on that stormy evening. He was living in Willemstad. He and his father were walking home from a friend's house late that night. They walked to the top of the dike. His father looked at his watch, looked at the level of the water.
And he said, you know, when that tide comes in, it's going to come over the dike.
If that happened, the town would be lost. Jerry and his dad went to wake up the mayor, who woke up the city council for an emergency meeting.
We sat in his room with the local notables, who simply decided that this could not happen because it had not happened before. So they would not ring the church bell. They would not wake people up.
An hour or so later, the icy water did come over the dike. The dike collapsed, and the water came thundering in. The next morning, Jerry went out with the search parties to look for survivors.
And we found my best friend and his family, and basically were alerted by his dog, who recognized me and came running over, and we found his body. He was also 9 years old.
The flood damage was widespread. 2,000 people died. 72,000 homes damaged or destroyed. As is typical with natural disasters, people demanded immediate action. The government responded. It launched an overhaul of its North Sea defenses. Engineers designed new storm surge barriers, new dams, and giant steel floodgates. The North Sea would never break through their defenses again.
We are here at the Maaslands Barrier in Hoek of Holland.
Jos Kuipers is with the Dutch Water Ministry. Maasland Barrier is the final piece of that overhaul launched 50 years ago. It's a massive floodgate not far from where the Maas River meets the North Sea.
You can compare it with two gigantic doors, one on the north side of the river and one on the south side on the river.
When a storm causes the North Sea to rise, the doors will swing shut.
And then they close off the whole river and keep high tides out.
Kuiper says this will protect Rotterdam and all the small, low-lying towns nearby. And it's easy to believe him. Standing below this giant steel structure, you get the feeling that it could withstand almost anything nature could throw at it. Even people who lived through the flood of 53 can feel safe now. But that's a problem.
Most people in the Netherlands rarely think about the fact that they're living below sea level or in a sensitive area.
Eric Boezenkool is with the Water Ministry's planning office in The Hague. He says the dams and barriers that were built after the 53 flood might be adequate if it were still 1953, but today there's something more insidious to worry about, which he describes in six words, give or take.
Climate change, climate change, and climate change.
If the Dutch people have tuned out the problem of climate change, the Dutch government has not. And for an American journalist like me, it's, well, unusual to hear a government official more worried about climate change than the general public.
One of the issues which we have to deal with in the coming years is to have create some type of sense of urgency, but we don't want to stir panic.
But how do you do that? Boezenkool isn't sure, but he says doing it is essential because the government is changing its strategy for dealing with water, and it's a change that will make people uncomfortable. After 1,000 years of trying to keep the water back, now the strategy is to let the water in. That's the thinking behind a project called Room for the River.
We are on the farm of Mr. Jacques Broekmans near the Meuse River.
René Persens is standing next to the Broekmans Dairy Barn. He's an official with the local municipal government. His job is to help Mr. Broekmans to relocate, because this farm is on one of the 40 parcels of land the government has designated as flood zones for the Meuse and Rhine rivers. Is Mr. Broekmans happy? No. But Persens says he will move.
Sometimes we don't agree about the price we have to pay for their farms, but eventually we will make a deal, I'm sure of that.
Because Persens believes, and the Dutch government believes, even Mr. Broekmans now believes that the safety of the country depends on it. Herr Mach says this idea of letting the water go where it wants is going to take some getting used to.
The Dutch are used to tame the nature, always to win. But now they have to accept retreat and to give parts of the country back to the water because it is better, because it is more clever.
And because climate change will force them to anyway. Joe Palka, NPR News.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. It's 2:54 Central Time. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our technical director this afternoon is Henry Frank. We were going to talk with pastry chef Sherry Yard in this portion of the program, but we haven't been able to get connected with her this afternoon, so we'll reschedule that. She's quite the interesting woman. She is a pastry chef. She's a two-time winner of a James Beard Award. She's executive pastry chef for Wolfgang Puck worldwide. And she is the author of two cookbooks. The latest is Desserts by the Yard, From Brooklyn to Beverly Hills, Recipes from the Sweetest Life Ever. So we'll try and reschedule that interview with Sherry Yard. In the meantime, let me tell you that coming up this afternoon on The World from PRI, a story about Zimbabwe. Once Zimbabwe was a prosperous nation, now its economy is in meltdown. We'll travel there undercover to learn why many in Zimbabwe feel desperate and betrayed. Zimbabweans speak out. That story in the day's news coming up this afternoon on The World. You can hear the program here on AM 580 Monday through Friday at 3 o'clock Central Time and at 7 p.m. in the evenings here on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Before you vote in the February 5th Illinois primary, find out where the candidates stand on the issues. Saturday evenings at 6, AM 580 will rebroadcast WILL-TV's specials, For the People, Primary Focus. John Paul moderates these discussions, co-sponsored by the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. That's For the People, Primary Focus, Thursday nights at 7:30 on WILL-TV and Saturday evenings at 6 here on AM 580.
Earth and Sky.
A space shuttle mission to service the Hubble Space Telescope in late 2008 will be well worth the risk involved, says NASA astronaut John Grunsfeld.
Well, in the fall of this year, we're going to go up to the Hubble Space Telescope on the space shuttle and put in a new suite of instruments that will essentially reinvent the telescope. The detector technology and the wavelength coverage that we'll have is going to allow us to have new views of the universe that are just going to astound and amaze everyone, scientists and amateur astronomers, everybody.
Grunsfeld and his crew of seven will install two new instruments and attempt the first ever repair in orbit of two key failed instruments. Scientists say the repairs and upgrades will increase the Hubble's capabilities by a hundredfold.
We're doing a marathon at a sprint pace for really the entire mission. From the time that we get to orbit, we do our inspections of the orbiter, we have to find and grapple Hubble, install it, and then we do five spacewalks, and then we deploy Hubble, and we do more inspections, and then we come home. So there's really no let-up of the pace at all.
Earth and Sky asked astronaut Grunsfeld why he and others risk their necks for the Hubble telescope.
I think the cause of science is something that's worth risking my life for, and how I've spent almost my entire adult life and most of my young life is in the pursuit of scientific knowledge. And Hubble is almost an icon for the quest of scientific knowledge.
More at our website. I'm Jorge Salazar for Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
2 minutes before 3 o'clock. You're tuned to the Information Advantage, WILL, Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana tonight: in the north, mostly cloudy. In central and southern sections tonight, partly cloudy. Lows ranging from 2 in far northern Illinois to 18 in the far south. Tomorrow, north, cloudy with periods of light snow. In central sections, increasing cloudiness with snow arriving late in the day. In the south tomorrow, mostly sunny. The highs tomorrow ranging from 12 in far northwestern Illinois to 37 in the far south. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, look for clear skies, the low 7, the wind from the west at 8 to 16 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny during the morning, then increasing cloudiness during the afternoon with a chance of some light snow towards sunset. The high tomorrow, 23. The wind from the west at 7 to 14 miles per hour. The outlook for tomorrow night, cloudy with some light snow and flurries during the evening hours, then clearing, windy and colder overnight, the low near 0. And the outlook for Thursday, mostly sunny and cold, the high 15. Up next, it's The World from PRI. Stay tuned.